stuck with us a little longer here. I'll pretty much cover the first part of the presentation, and then Franz will cover the second part. I want to hit the high-level issues here. I don't want to go through too much technical detail. I'll try to do it as best I can. Some of these issues are always technical. Just say in terms of process, I don't want to spend too long because we talked about it before. We gave as much common time as we were able to do. Basically, the minister released, he made his budget announcement in February on the 21st, on the 20th. We had hoped to release the legislation on the 21st. We thought we did. We did have a website problem that was referred to, so therefore everybody got it on the 22nd. We sort of fell within about an 8-9 business day rule. We would have liked to give more time, but to note, we try to consult as widely as possible. Whenever we send out something on the website, we always have an email to all of the relevant people who are interested in tax matters. So we don't just rely on a website. We publicly announce and make sure people have direct receipt of these things so they can keep an eye as an alert basis. Again, we've consulted throughout. After our hearings last week, we had further consultations as proposed, and I think we worked out a reasonable compromise, which is the basis of discussion today. Over here, just as a general overview, what we've dealt with in pages 2, 3, 4, 5, and 2, 3, pages 2, 3, 4, and 5 are about the urgent anti-avoidance matters, and that's really been the main subject of discussion when it comes to this bill. Turning over to page 6 is some quick retirement issues. Then there are some technical policy issues, and then there are a number of important administrative issues starting on page 10. But I'll take us through, and we'll get to the high-level notes. Turning to page 2 and 3, this is ultimately where the meat of the deal and discussion is. And that came around intra-group reorganization. And as we said, the purpose of intra-group relief was designed as deferral, that you can move assets around the group and any gain would be deferred, and that those transactions were misused and people were using them as disguised exemption cash outs. So they got complete exemption when they sold one business to another, and basically what happened is if you had lots of money and you wanted to sell big businesses, your gains would be tax-free where others were not. And as a matter of fairness, we had to deal with that. The issue that came up, however, is while we attacked the wolves, the argument was is we unfortunately had many sheep that were a victim along the road. And so the question became, as is always the question in tax, to separate the sheep from the wolves. The problem is there are many, many innocent sheep, but when it comes to the wolves, they often have a lot of money at stake. We had a follow-up consultation with the industry, and basically we came to a new formula approach. And what we did is, in the basic adjustment, it was about the solution. It wasn't about the problem, but it was the solution. And the solution that was recommended by the group overall was that it was to alter the degrouping charge. Because the way the original solution worked, you were not allowed to do any intragroup cash transfers, and when you did an intragroup loan, we reduced the base cost in the loan. That created a lot of problems, and that part of the amendment we've pulled back on. We've decided to solve the problem another way. And the way we've solved it is we've enhanced the degrouping charge. So under the original law as it stands today, if a buyer and a seller in a group do an intragroup transfer, gain is triggered if the assets leave the group or if the group breaks up between buyer and seller. That is the original law today. But the proposal is to add to that and say it's not the group, a group breakup will not occur not just when buyer and seller separate, but when they separate from their parent organizations. So it's separation from buyer and seller and for every controlling parent. If you do that, you will prevent the disguised cash outs as proposed. There is a little bit of overbreadth in that proposal, but based on a discussion with industry last week, they were more willing to accept that overbreadth, and we can fix that with a little bit of experience over time. So expect a little bit of refinement to make sure that the last one or two sheep that may be out there that we will spare them. So essentially, I think the industry should be pleased with that change. Now, there's also another little technical problem which we're also dealing with, that solution generally works, but there's still one little escape hatch which we're still mulling over, but we're under discussion on that. But overall, I think the big thing was they wanted to allow the use of cash in an intragroup transfer, and when they used an intragroup loan, they wanted a fair market value-based cost. They are getting that. So I think the industry will be fine. Now, before I leave that subject, and that is the subject, is what we found was that intragroup, while it was intended for a rollover of assets, had also had that homemade use to allow for leverage buyout, and that we're accepting. The worry we had originally was about the Sky's cash outs, and the proposed legislation deals with that. However, in the course of the deliberations, it became evidently apparent that there is a second avoidance scheme out there. And that avoidance scheme goes beyond 45. And what was discussed before was BEE and some other deals where the deal itself overall is an important and commercial deal. But what you see is that people add to the deal. They pile on. So to give an example, BEE, although it is not the only example there, a legitimate BEE deal goes through with external funding. But all the deal really needs is, say, $5 million. All it needs. But through a second scheme, the bank decides to lend $100 million. So $95 million is lent. And the purpose of the $95 million is to just be a funnel, to just do a big circle around. And in this great circle, what happens is the financier ends up with a double deduction. And with that double deduction, the bank says, because I'm getting a double deduction, I will lower the terms for the group itself. And it's basically, I'm going to have to show you the transaction with another set of charts, but I'm just flagging it to you because we're still under discussion there. What basically is happening is the BEE or the securitization deal, perfectly legitimate, is used as a pretext to pile on avoidance on top. And what happens is they use that as a disguise. And then what happens is the financier gives a double deduction, and we lose a lot of money to the fiscus. And what you heard last week is in those deals, the BE partner is getting this much, and you will hear in the deal touted how generous those people are. But at the end of the day, the fiscus in tax losses is giving that much. So the generosity is not free. Those deals must be attacked, but we could not attack it through 45 while we're still contemplating that because we felt that we would get hit more innocent sheep. We are planning to address that fairly quickly. We do believe a number of those transactions are susceptible to the GAR. Why they're getting around the GAR, I'm not sure. To me, it's about aggressive opinion writing, but I could be wrong. I don't know the full details, but I know a fair amount at this stage. We will be coming back on that issue. And it's a very important issue. The question is when? How do we deal with the effective date on that? But clearly, we wanted to make sure that the legitimate deals go through. That's the essence of that. Then, turning onward, we had two other sets of deals. That's really basically page 2 and 3. Page 4, I'm just trying to make sure I've got my vision here a little bit. I'm getting old. Is that on page 4, there was a second set of deals where foreigners were using treaty relief, a treaty exemption, to multiply through the group. So what happened is a foreign person would have an exemption when they own South African shares. This is an international standard. Foreigners who sell South African shares are exempt from capital gains tax, and that is the dominant world position, and it is also enshrined in treaties. There is nothing wrong with that principle. However, what happens is the foreign investor owning a South African parent company tries to multiply that exemption throughout the group, through all the lower tier subsidiaries. So a foreign-owned operation gets a multiple exemption at the end of the day, whereas the wholly domestic entity is fully subject to tax. That was the deal we decided to go after. There was a lot of criticisms, however, that again, we picked up many innocent sheep. So we have narrowed the proposal to make sure that the foreigner exemption fully sticks, except when they're involved in this form of multiplication. And I think when the people see the adjustments here, I think that will get rid of most of the concerns on foreign investment. That's basically on page 4. Page 5, there was the issue of re-domiciling. As we said before, there are many incentives in our system in order to encourage you to bring the assets onshore and bring the cash back home in order to enrich and support the headquarters South African company. This is another theme that you'll hear again, that while we want to promote incentives that enhance South African headquarter companies, South African multinationals. They are an important part of our franchise in South Africa. This is what makes South Africa a much stronger country than many other countries around the world, and we do try to promote those kind of things. However, once again, you try to do one thing and you get another. And what happens, again, is that those exemptions are used not to just bring the money back home, but to strip the headquarter company. And we saw some more things again, and what we did is to close them down. However, there was some criticism that what we were doing, again, was about the solution. That the solution was punishing the repatriation of funds when you really should be making sure that a tax applies on exit. And really, it's not a matter about punishment. Basically, when we're talking about this area, is that there's actual incentives to bring the money back home. We just want to make sure those incentives are used to enhance the headquarter company, not to undermine it. It's really a question about incentives. So we've taken up the suggestion that we will make sure that we keep the bringing back home as incentivized as possible, but the exit is where that incentive will no longer exist. Last issue, but not least, is the issue of effective dates. Now, I don't have a perfect answer here. One of the things that was a fairly contentious issue is, when do we make this effective? Now, in the past, when we have seen high-level avoidance, we have often made it effective as of the date of media release or as of the date of legislative draft release. What made this, and that has happened before, and we've seen, when we're talking here, we're talking about high-level deals. We're talking about large amounts to the fiscus, and we're trying to protect that. What happened in the case of 45 was that because there were so many sheep out there, the effective date has disrupted a number of those deals. So at this stage, we are putting the effective date under consideration. We are still debating within the Treasury and within the South African Revenue Service a proper effective date. And what we need to do is balance. We want to make sure to give the market certainty that they know their deals won't be disrupted. On the other hand, we don't want to give fiscal stability to tax avoidance arrangements. And it's that proper balancing that we want to be fair in how we proceed. So we will come back to you, and Chairman, and hopefully I can communicate with you informally as soon as a decision is made in that regard. And that decision will have to be made in the next day or two. So but my apologies that we don't have an exact date yet. We clearly know our principle, but the date still has to be determined. The farther you push out the date, it often becomes a pretext for people to do a little interim planning. On the other hand, we want to make sure that give people certainty. So that is balancing of issues there. Don't know if you want to, okay, I can keep going or we can pause it for a question. You tell me how to proceed. Okay, the next set of issues, and I'm only going to deal really with page 6, and the other issues I'm going to deal with just one, so I don't want to go through too many here. There is issues around pension taxation. Pages 6 is the key. And on page 6, just to remind you, in the pension tax area, there has been a number of informal practices and coordination issues. For example, a lot of our pension tax legislation really dates back to the 1980s, and much of it didn't take into account commercial realities. And so the Revenue Service very obligingly has come up with a number of practice notes to make that regime workable. And they did that over a number of years. What the law is doing is codifying those practices to continue that flexibility and make it transparent so everybody know the rules clearly and openly. That is fine. Most of this stuff is designed to be procedural, and it was also designed to make sure that we had better linkage with the Pension Amendment Act, the Pension Act. However, two issues emerged. One was a living annuity provider. Now, the issue of who can offer a living annuity is a very important one. The way it works is in the retirement area is that many retirement vehicles require, in order to get exemption, in order to get incentive treatment, once that vehicle closes, you have basically what they call as a two-third, one-third formula. So you put your money into a retirement vehicle, and we want you to use it for retirement. That's why you're getting the incentive. At the end of the day, what happens is upon retirement, you can take out one-third lump sum in cash, but we require two-thirds to come out in the form of an annuity. An annuity is one is a guaranteed annuity over the remaining of your life. That's one choice. The second one that has emerged is something called a living annuity, where you don't have to wait till you pass away, and that there is an amount of flexibility as to when you make the withdrawal. Now, there have been issues about over-withdrawals and so forth, but sometimes that flexibility is very important. Now, in order to have that vehicle work, you have to have something called an annuity. Under current law, in order to be an annuity, you have to be offered by a long-term insurance provider. However, there was a Supreme Court case that has thrown that into doubt, and we went to clarify that, and we also, in the original amendments, were bringing in additional industry players because we said this is a living annuity, not a guaranteed annuity, and therefore you don't have it over the life, you just have it over a shorter period. However, we have taken that amendment out as of this stage because we felt it was premature. This was really just this bill was really supposed to be dealing in this area more non-substantive issues. It was more of a procedural question. And so at the moment, the current law stands as is, but this issue will have to come back for further consideration. So I know that's an important issue for some. I do think it's worthy of discussion. But clearly, this is more of a financial sector policy thing than a tax thing. And so we were a little premature in that, and that was a bit of a technical problem, frankly, on my part. And we should not have released it at this stage. It needs further discussion and debate. So that is an issue I think we should come back to. Then there's an issue around divorce. Divorce causes a lot of emotions in pension. The reason why is under current law, and it's been changed recently, but under old law, you could be married to somebody for a long period of time, but you were stuck together in your pension fund until retirement. Now, having been through a divorce, being stuck together once you've broken up from that marriage for another 20, 30 years becomes a very emotional issue. The problem is technically unraveling that. We have unraveled it in part. Pension Amendment Acts did so several months back, and we are moving toward a clean break principle. But that full clean break principle is still lagging in the tax world. We needed to make these amendments first, have further deliberations, but hopefully by the end of the year, we will have a clean break principle that upon divorce, the pension funds separate, and never the twain shall meet again. From a tax and a pension point of view. But people have asked us, where is that amendment? That amendment is still, you know, underway. We fixed it on the pension side. We're just trying to clean it up on the tax side. There are a few more technical coordination issues required. Then turning now to pages 7, 8, 9, et cetera, jump to page 9 on expatriate housing. The other issues start becoming really esoteric. Again, this was an issue that came up. What happened over a number of years was that a number of foreign skilled expatriates were within South Africa, and there was a disagreement on interpretation. And the Revenue Service said, well, if you're a visitor, a short-term visitor, you can get tax-free accommodation, sort of when you come to a hotel visit. Short-term accommodation is really just a working condition fringe. I mean, I know a number of you travel. You don't want to have to be paid. You don't want to add to your fringe benefit tax the visit to the hotel you're required to do for work. Unfortunately, that amendment began to have a life of its own. And a number of taxpayers were taking a position, skilled expatriates, that they can stay in the country many, many years with free accommodation and that was considered part of their working condition fringe. Last year we went to close that amendment, and we said you have a one-year time frame. There was some pushback and discussion, and what we did is we've extended that to a two-year period, and the comments here are in relation to that. Now, the first one was there has been further requests that it really should be a four-year period. And there really is a debate around that. And the request was made again. At this stage, we remain committed to the two-year time frame. And the reason why we remain committed to the two-year time frame was the two-year time frame is based on the idea that most short-term foreign-skilled expats are going to typically have to maintain a dual home. If you leave your house for a year, do you really want to sell it? You know, you probably don't. So we've had a fairly generous two-year period to say, look, 2 years, you're probably going to maintain a home. It was a matter of rough justice proxy. Once you start getting the third, fourth, fifth year, you start saying, well, you know, you're really here such a long time, you're not really going to want to maintain two homes in that situation. So that is the reason for the two-year period. It also links up some home affairs permits for short-term nature. But it's really about the idea of not trying to make sure you have a double cost. It's like a hotel stay. You don't sell your house when you go up for a hotel. So it's you get exemption to make sure you don't have to worry about double accommodation costs. The purpose of this exemption, though, is not an incentive. It's really to make sure to remove that double cost. So we remain committed to that. The second issue came up around the caps. And the question was, the 25,000 cap is too low. Now, remember, what they're saying is that accommodation for 25,000 per month is not enough to live on. Yeah, that's I think, was the reaction. Yes. Yeah, certainly not my home. But, again, that would be quite an interest rate where we are. But the point is that the request was to jump it to 50,000. Now, with first blush, that's the feeling. But an issue arose in discussion that said, what if you're here in the hotel? Now, in the hotel, you're going to get charged maybe $1,000 or $2,000 a day. Now, some of these skilled expats come in, and they stay in a hotel, especially on the short-term stays. And there, it could quickly go over $25,000 if you're there for a month. So that seemed to us a legitimate point. So what we've done is we've sort of broken up the expatriate visiting exemption to two parts. Longer-term stays are subject to the 25,000 cap, but if you're in the country for 90 days or less, that's obviously you're going to be here in a hotel, and therefore there's no ceiling in that case. You can choose any hotel you want, and that's typically the way we do it domestically. You go wherever you go, you stay in the hotel. Should you stay, I guess it was called the Sheraton Arabella, or what one time was called the Cullinan, my names are behind, you can stay there. It's a working condition fringe. Don't worry about it. So that's where we are on that one. So there was a partial compromise in that regard. There was also another issue around the ceiling. The ceiling had a twofold element. One was the lower of 50,000, lower of 25,000 or 25% of your salary. So there was another cap. So if you were earning less income, you had to worry about yet another cap. And we just eliminated the percentage cap and just said make it a straight monetary cap. We also did that for administrative reasons because the percentage cap created a whole host of problems. The other one was requests for time. As you said, there are two parts to the rule. There's a two-year rule and a 30-day, 90-day rule. And we simplified those rules. We said there's a two-year rule and a 90-day rule. You can come in for short-term 90 days without a ceiling. The other one is you come in for 2 years. A request was made to bring it up beyond a 30-day temporary period, because the original period was a 30-day period, to 183 days in line with tax treaties. Now, it sounds very compelling at first, the 183-day argument, but that's a six-month period already. Being in a hotel for 6 months, that's now getting to be a different issue. We felt that the treaty comparison wasn't proper, because the treaty exemption only applies where you have a foreign payor. It doesn't apply where you have a South African payor. And there are other technical differences as well with the treaty. So again, it's been limited to 90 days, but I think there have been some concessions here to make it more generous. And that's it on page 10, and now I turn it to Franz.
We're sharing a microphone today, I think. It's just been interesting watching the expatriate exemption, because if you recall, last year we started off with 183 days as a comprehensive cap. that's now moved to 2 years, and now we'd like to start moving the 30 days to 183 days. So it's interesting how these things move on as the debate continues. I think we have made a fair degree of change here to accommodate the expatriates. Turning to the administrative issues, the first point that came up was, you recall what we suggested is that SARS will now pay and charge interest from, if it's an individual, 7 months after the end of the tax year. Okay, that assists people who are in a refund situation, and it does mean people who've been late on their payments end up paying some interest. Now, there's a question as to whether that's fair. We think it is. 7 months is a fairly long period to allow people to work out if they've short paid. If they have short paid, they then have the option, if they want to, of making a payment to SARS so they don't have to pay interest. So the other point to bear in mind is that the filing season will typically end within those 7 months. So you're going to have had to complete your tax return in any event. And once you've completed your tax return, you then definitely know how much you owe SARS. And so again, you're in a position to top up, as we sort of refer to it in passing, if you want to avoid the interest. On the other hand, if you want to use SARS as a bank, and we're not the cheapest bank around, we're also not the most expensive, that is an option available to you too. Medical schemes, at the moment we have a problem, and this is now on page 11, in that employers are treating the way they deal with medical aid contributions differently. So what we were looking for is a more consistent treatment. It's been pointed out the solution that was proposed technically has a problem in that it forces the employer to take all medical aid contributions into account, whether the employer deals with them or not. So theoretically, people could come with slips of paper and say, well, you know, there's my statement for the medical aid, please take it into account. That could be an administrative problem for employers. So the suggested solution there is that where the employer runs the medical aid through the payroll system, those must be taken into account. If it is not run through the payroll system, the employer may take it into account. Okay, so if the employer wishes to assist employees, that is open to them. On the other hand, if it is something that is a condition of service, it's something that's built into the payroll system, then we expect the employer to take it into account because the data is all there. The penalty on late submission by employers of the annual reconciliation, this has been criticized as well. The first point we'd make is that the 10% penalty is consistent with the other pay-as-you-earn penalties. The second point we make is that the 60-day deadline that we have here is something that's been in the law for many, many years. Unfortunately, it's something that quite a few employers have decided is not that serious, that they need to comply with it. The problem with that is it leads to spin-offs with problems for the employees when they're going to be assessed, because we are not in a position to verify that, in fact, the pay as you earn that is on the IRP 5 was ever paid over to us. We've got the monthly payments, we've got some IRP 5s, but we need to reconcile the two. And without the reconciliation from the employer, that really does create significant problems both on the assessment and audit process for employees. So we're suggesting we need to stick to that. The 60 days, if you look internationally, is well in the middle of the pack. There are countries that give employers 3 weeks to get this reconciliation. There are countries that require this on a monthly basis. So 2 months after year end is something that is certainly not leading edge, if you want to call it that, in international terms. Having said all of that, and it's a point we've made before, we do appreciate that some employers have let their system slide because they have not been sticking to the 60-day limit. And so in the first year that the penalty comes into operation, we will apply it with a degree of leniency to allow employers to catch up. A proposal that gave rise to a fair amount of comment as well was one that said that if the employer has not provided that reconciliation to SARS, we will not give credit to the employees for the pay as you earn on the IRP 5. Now, that really is an internal control issue. Again, if we don't know that that particular IRP 5's pay as you earn was really paid over to us, how can we be giving people refunds out of that money? Is it real money, or is this just a piece of paper that we have in front of us, or that the employee's been using? Having said that, we do appreciate that that is something that would give rise to difficulties for employees, because in many cases, that's a procedural problem on the employer's side. The employee has in fact had that tax deducted from their salary, and SARS is now potentially going to be assessing them again for the tax without giving them the credit for that which has been deducted. So what we're doing here is we've got a couple of other possible approaches to handling this. Essentially, there are two that we can think of. The one is that the IRP 5 may not be issued until such time as the reconciliation has been submitted to SARS. And the alternative is that SARS will not process a taxpayer's return until such time as the reconciliation has been submitted. Each has advantages and disadvantages, but both of those options are options that would have less of an impact than this particular proposal. Moving on to VAT, one of the proposals was that we do away with the ability to make refunds into third-party bank accounts. The concern here is that are we making the refund into the right third-party bank account? It does introduce an element of risk for taxpayers and for SARS. The comments basically came back and said there are practical reasons why we do need to have this facility. We accept that. We're proposing to withdraw the amendment and study the issue further in consultation with the people who are being affected. And then finally, there's been a bit of confusion about the effective date for the change from a VAT registration threshold of 300,000 to 1 million. People are trying to get it in as quickly as possible. That is unfortunately not something that will be possible, because that increase is inextricably linked with the whole idea of the new simplified tax system for small business, which goes up to 1 million. So we're going to have to introduce the two of them concurrently, and so that is something that will not be happening until the small business, simplified small business tax system comes into operation.
Okay. Anything else? Is that it? Okay. Members, questions, comments? Malata, Mr. Singh, Ms. Fox.
Thank you, Chair. And mine's just
Mr. Murray.
Thank you, Chair. Mine's just one simple question on page 3. You're saying the commissioner will be empowered from... Let's move to the next one. First, the commissioner will be empowered to obtain special reporting for reorganization. And the second one is the minister may empower commissioner pre-approval of certain reorganization via regulations. My question is, how the commissioner know, how the commissioner be notified in advance about this reorganization? Because this second one, it's not yet definite. It's a may.
Mr. Singh? Mr. Singh.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I thought you said song, and I was just wondering which song I should sing.
You? As long as the song has to be sung by Mr. Singh, it's fine.
Everybody will leave if I start singing. Thank you. First of all, Chair, just from our side, to thank our team from National Treasury and SARS and the respondents for what would seem to be very intensive discussions and negotiations. I'm sure 24 hours out of 24 hours were spent in the last few days coming up with this document here. Just two questions on page 10, and then also notice that Prof. France made fewer concessions than Keith, so I don't know what happened there. On page 10, the one about provisional taxpayers and the seven-month period, I think I heard Prof. France say that 7 months they'll be given. Now, last year there was e-filing up to 31st January. Will that change this year? Because that's well over the 7 months. And then on page 12, the first year leniency for those that do not submit the reconciliations. Is this going to be enshrined in the law, or is it just going to be something that SARS is going to use? Should we not say that this will be effective from the next tax year or something like that? Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Pops.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Minor, one is just perhaps a clarification on what Treasury meant, SARS, in the comment made about on page 6, retirement saving vehicles, notwithstanding the very positive response, the comment was, we are now taking into account the realities. I was just assuming we've always done that. But to come to the question I really want to pose on page 9, is the expatriate housing. In the middle of that paragraph under if, the comment is made that employees who were in South Africa for more than 30 days in the prior tax year will not qualify for tax-free accommodation. I was assuming that each tax year is taken separately, and I'm not sure if that isn't just a superfluous comment or am I missing something. Are you trying to say that there are some members who file their taxes who try to do this over 2 years? You know, I'm not sure of the exact nature of your comment here, so I can't ask my question more specifically.
Mr. Marais.
Thank you, Chair. My first comment will also be compliments to Treasury and SARS. I think you know, the major concerns that we have had, which is basically aligned with what the people, you know, the submissions were saying. I mean, it's wonderful that you are so empathetic in terms of the realities, in terms of also challenges of getting foreign investment in South Africa. So absolutely wonderful. Just two comments or questions. On the effective dates, I understand what you're saying in terms of the effective dates and that is under consideration. But I also know from reality is that normally companies want to plan what they do and that they are not caught between the devil and the deep blue sea. So I think that's only fair and reasonable to take that into consideration. Then on page 13 to SARS, also on the credit of the pay as you earn and under consideration, surely, France, there is a legal relationship between an employer and SARS. So that obviously makes sense to me as well to not bring into the whole equation the employee who has fulfilled and complied with all their requirements and then basically penalize that. So that's also fantastic that is under consideration. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, sir. The matter for me would be a matter that is outside of this, but linked very much with your page 6 that talks here A and B. And I would imagine here, whilst you are having all sorts of people responding to some of those taxation laws amendments, you would also have some of those who might not have been able to make the necessary presentations during hearings. The case in point here would be the special pensions. There has been an outcry to the effect that those have been heavily taxed, and there has been a view that you need to really and force here exemption in this regard. There hasn't been any response to that effect. Of course, maybe the point here is there hasn't been any, you know, formal presentation to that effect. I would really speak for those. and perhaps they're being in a position to engage further on the matter. Maybe not here, as time goes, we might wish to hear your comments on that. The special tax regime that has been, pension regime as it were, that would need to be further engaged, specifically on the tax matters.
The last one is Mr. Mgun.
Thank you. I just want to make a follow-up on the ship that will be left through. on page 4, you're saying they'd be allowed to those companies that you give a 2-year period for companies to disband. Now, my question is, will you be able, as SARS, to be able to support that this is a legitimate unbundling or this is not a legitimate unbundling? And how much are we going to, do we expect to lose if we let those ships to pass through?
Let me respond first to Mr. Melotto's comments. I think I'm glad you highlighted the point because I skipped over that, and I think it's a very important point. There was the issue about reporting and pre-approvals. One of the things that came out of the discussion last week with industry, and all of the industry players supported this, was that they felt that you needed to have a heightened sense of reporting in this 45 area. Because they said the problem is here, the way the current process works is you do the reorganization today, and as Franz pointed out last week, it's only going to be about a year or two later before the assessor is going to be able to see the deal. By then, the wolves have already eaten up a few of the sheep and other things, and now you've got to get them to regurgitate it and so forth. So it makes it a very difficult situation. Also, if there is no spotlights, people can operate in the shade. And what the concept was is let's get full reporting here, full disclosure, and that way the more aggressive deals will suddenly come into the light and they'll stay away. So there were two parts to the proposal. One is we've given, when it comes to information reporting, we generally like to leave that to the commissioner's discretion. We're not talking about substance here. We're not talking about penalties. We are talking about when you're required to report. Just describe the transaction and when you're supposed to do so. At one time in the law, we give you spell out when. The bottom line is the law is not a good instrument for reporting information. You give the commissioner the power, and then you have reporting that follows. So the commissioner is empowered for that reporting. That's part one. The second part was that this was an old provision that we had, and we took it out. We said that a number of these reorganizations, we may want to have pre-approval, that you cannot conduct the reorganization unless the commissioner gives advanced approval. And we had a regulatory space with that about 2 years ago, but we felt it was unnecessary, and we deleted it. But upon reconsideration, there was a feeling that maybe we need to restore that power to the minister, and it would be by regulation. So the minister would say, in these circumstances, the commissioner may require pre-approval before you proceed. Those details haven't yet been worked out, unfortunately, because the proposal only emerged as of last week. So the details on that still are to follow. I'm more than happy that we should show the regulation to the committee so they can see that. But what we're trying to do is we don't want pre-approval for every reorganization because that's going to bog down everybody's process. We're just trying to pick out the ones that are of concern. And it's that balancing of interest that we're going to have to return. So that's really a restoration of the old rules. But the substance will remain the same as it is in law. It's just to make sure a question of timing issues. The second issue is Mr. Nguni has raised the issue about on page 4 about the connected foreign persons and the 2-year rule. Now, what you have in the tax law, this is not unusual, is when you see an anti-avoidance transaction, what you often try to do is it's usually there's two parts of a deal. There's a stage 1 and a stage 2. And what we have is a number of anti-avoidance rules, which fall around 18 months, 2 years, 5 years. Usually what happens is that you want to do a deal. There's something you really want to do. If you forget the tax lawyers, this is your plan of action. And then in the middle of the deal, the tax lawyer wants you to make an adjustment. And usually these deals have a certain time pressure with them. So the client never would just come out and come forward to the tax person. It's always part of the side deal. And the purpose of the timing requirements is to say, if you're in the middle of that deal and you're trying to play games, and we know that you're making a shift in the middle, then we're gonna hit. And the point is that the time frame does become an issue, because most clients, you can tell them 18 months, they say fine, but usually they're not willing to wait more than 6. That's just the way they are. They just having that's my prior U.S. experience. People are impatient. So the question was the balancing over time. We have found that an 18-month, 2-year period is pretty effective. But again, there are questions for those who are patient. Many of the rules in the tax code can be maneuvered around. Usually, however, people are not patient, and that gets the bulk. The problem is a balance in there. You're trying to limit the time frame, because if you don't, then you pick up too many sheep. But there might be a few wolves in there, so it's a fair enough question. Let's see here. Mr. Moran, thank you for that note on the issue of the balancing. There is the effective date issue, and as I said, we are right now, we know the principle of the balancing. The question is the exact date. That is the issue. So we will try to be as fair as possible while protecting the fiscus, and I thank you for that note. The other things now, there was an issue on living annuities that was there, and it was raised. The point is that we use the wrong phraseology there. Just to repeat, on the living annuity providers, the real question is a procedural one. This bill is not really a substantive bill. We only addressed extreme anti-avoidance measures and technical corrections. We just felt it was premature on this issue so that everybody would have the full comment that everybody wants on this issue. So I think that's all we can say, and that was an unfortunate thing. Now, the other question is, Mr. Johnson raised issues about incentives about retirement. Let me just say this. We have been relaxing the taxation of retirement quite considerably over the last few years. If you remember, the taxation on retirement funds was a big issue. That when you built up your money in retirement, we used to impose an RFT. And that was actually the biggest contentious issue. And gradually the minister reduced, and now has eliminated it. So pensions grow tax-free. Money you put into a pension is deductible. The question sometimes comes up is taking money out. But even last year, if you take money out in a lump sum, we have special relief provisions there. So I welcome the engagement on that one. If you can please give us feedback in detail, I think we would be very interested. But we have made moves. The question is, have we gone far enough? And that I just need more detail on. Do you want to take it from there? The expats? Okay. Let me. The last is on the expats. Ms. Phubbs asked a question about this 30-day, 90-day, and I do think Franz will have to be jumping in here because my explanation, I think, will be somewhat flawed. There is some question about how to make the two rules work together. This is a technical issue. You know, how do you make the 90-day rule work with the 2-year rule so people don't start playing games in and out? And the point is, what you're trying to say is if you're in the country for a short, brief period of time, that won't affect your 2-year rule. But once you start coming in a little longer, the 2-year rule starts being impacted. So that's just a general explanation. But I think Franz can give a better detail on that integration because I think my explanation will be sloppy.
Thanks, Keith. Essentially, your concern here is that take this situation. Someone comes in for a year, leaves for a year, comes in for a year, leaves for a year, comes in for a year, leaves for a year. Do you want to give a concession for that? Somebody who comes in for 6 months, leaves, comes back for 6 months, do you want to give a concession for that? So what the rule is trying to do is say, right, where you have somebody who is in the country for less than 90 days, that's all we count. It's the the 90 days? Because that typically is someone who's just here on short. Maybe it's a technical consultant who's coming in for 3 weeks to look at something, something of that nature. When you start moving across more than 3 months, then we start thinking, well, you're here for a fairly significant period of time. Keith's already mentioned at this point you're probably not staying in a hotel anymore. You're not probably staying in a furnished apartment or something of that nature. It's a long-term stay. And then you're into the bigger question of the two-year rule. Okay, so then we say you have up to 2 years that you can be in the country. But to stop the sort of in-out, in-out situation, we look at the year before and we say, were you in the country for more than 90 days in that year before? Because if you were, that should count towards your 2 years. If you were in the country for less than 90 days, then it is in that short-term stay system, not in the long-term stay system. Or the, let's not say long-term, rather, but the sort of short- to medium-term stay system. So you, if you want to sort of think about a conception, you almost have two systems running in parallel here. You've got a short-term system, and you've got a longer-term system, and then all we're trying to manage is the crossover between the two. On the question of the number of concessions, I just quickly counted. There were 7 comments. We've accepted 2. We have 1 under consideration. So we're just a little bit less than 50%. On the question of the first year's leniency for employers, no, we don't believe that should be enshrined because you're going to be in a situation where there are going to be a number of different factors at play. And to try and work out all those factors are, for something that's going to be for 1 year, probably doesn't make a lot of sense. But SARS is committing to be more lenient in the first year of operation. That feeds into the question of delaying it for a year. Well, all that will happen if we delay it for a year is that next year everyone will say, well, we need you to be lenient this year because it's the first year of operation. So I don't think it really gets you there. Because South Africans being what we are, we tend to wait for the deadline to hit us before we worry about it. On the question of the 7 months, I think this year we will have shorter periods for filing. I think we will still have, I can't speak to what exactly the periods are going to be. But the point to be made here is that even if you are e-filing and even if there is an extended period past the 7 months for e-filing, you still have 7 months to at least do your rough calculation of how much tax you owe us. And if you see that you're significantly short, top up. Okay. For most people, this is not going to be an issue. For most people, the amount of pay you earn that was deducted by the employer is going to, in fact, cover their tax bill. And there may be a short, small refund because perhaps they traveled more than the pay you earn system sort of approximates that they're going to be traveling. Or maybe they traveled less and they've got a car allowance and, in fact, they have to pay in a little. But the fact of the matter is, on that situation, in either case, we're going to pay or charge interest. And it's actually interesting because if you think about it, the taxpayer is in a position to make a sort of top-up payment, but SARS is not in a position to give you a top-up refund. So SARS is going to be paying interest and can only make the refund once the assessment has been done. Again, on the comments about the credit of the pay as you earn, we welcome that comment. I just think I need to revisit it a little. It's true that the employer and SARS have a relationship, but the employee clearly does come into the picture because the employee gets the credit for what the employer did or didn't do. And that's where there is a bit of a linkage that somehow we need to address and that we are trying to address here. Yeah, I think that sort of covers the questions that were directed my way.
Good morning. I just wanted to check something. During the presentations, a lot of presenters did mention that there is a need to introduce group taxation. I have not heard you guys, touch on it. because like they indicated that there are several inadequacies that are found in the current legislation, especially with regard to legislating the companies. So I wanted your comment on that to check whether that is feasible. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, you know, while one appreciates the balancing act and trying to realign the technicalities and the point that was covered in relation to expatriate housing, I think part of the dilemma that is likely to be encountered, which involves not only the public, private sector, but also the public sector, is the tendency, and perhaps a very good one, pattern, to bring in certain specialists for short periods of time, 3 months here at a particular period to address certain matters, and indeed Treasury itself has done this. And then again, the following tax year, the same thing, and so on and so forth. And I don't think that is abusing. I think the intention there was we only need such a person for 3 months and almost a secondment from a parent company or parent public sectoral issue. And I would have thought that it is not the intention to have negative, spin-outs from this. And I do see that although you're trying to address the abuse here, that you may find yourself falling foul of even the public sector in this regard, which in certain areas in the parastatals offers such terms and conditions. Thank you.
On the question of group taxation, I mean, that is something that has bubbled around since the Katz Commission days. The fact of the matter, though, is it can be very, very complex to introduce. And I think back, if you think of a leading economy like Japan only introduced group taxation, I think it was 3 or 4 years ago. So we're talking about something that is not easy to do. So it is something that is there. It is something that we do revisit from time to time, but it's not something we're going to do this year. On the question of expatriates, again, this is why we have a three-month rule, which allows for that sort of short-term visit. I mean, I concede SARS has somebody that comes out for a couple of weeks, but that's perfect. That's less than the 90 days. If you had someone who came out for 6 months, well, they would fall into the two-year rule. So they could come in for 6 months in the first year, they could come in for 6 months in the second year, and they'd be fine. They would then get the exemption up to the 25,000 Rand cap. If they came in for 6 months in the third year, there'd be an issue. But we're getting something that's now starting to look very repetitive. And then the question is how much of a favorable treatment you want to give that person compared to someone domestically, because you could have a domestic consultant coming in for 6 months. I mean, you do start having those trade-offs. Just something Keith did mention on the thinking behind the two-year rule, which is that you're maintaining two homes. I mean, it's not necessarily the case that you'll be selling the home. You may, in fact, be renting it out. And again, that's a useful point to bear in mind when comparing the domestic and foreign situation. Because in the domestic situation where you have somebody who is transferring, we don't have a cap. However, if that person rents out the home, they don't have the dual expense problem, and that falls completely within the tax system. If you have someone who's foreign, they in fact may be renting out the home on a longer term stay, and that leg of the transaction is not in the South African tax system. So there are differences in the situation that you do need to bear in mind when looking at it.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Johnson, I wanted
to... Chair, on the same issue that I raised, without, you know, being a tax fundi myself, I guess one would still need to be, you know, taught a little or two. The Special Pensions falls under Special Pensions Act. The issue for me there is the beneficiaries do receive at any given point in time a lump sum. Maybe you were addressing the issue, but more from a retirement point of view. To an extent, maybe this will have an effect on this special pension regime that we have. Maybe, I don't know. My point there is, previously the experience has been that those lump sums have not been tax deducted, tax exempted rather. And there has been an outcry in that regard, having to really address the issue, and the point being exempt tax on those lump sums for those special pension beneficiaries. Whether this will also fall in line with the retirement processes that are taking place and having to eliminate those is a question in point. If you could respond on that. That has been our question then.
Yeah, I'll allow the digression. It's a complete digression, but I'll allow it.
Thank you, Chair. The response there is that the special pensions are in fact dealt with separately because they are a state pension, if you put it that way. And I think something we do need to bear in mind is when those pensions are set and when they were designed, the fact that they were taxable were taken into account. So you have a question of if you now later on want to change the tax treatment of them, then you have to revisit how they were set in the original case as well. So I think that is something that we would have to really take as a separate submission and Treasury and yourself engage on, because you've got multiple factors you need to bear in mind on this one. And I think that is something you probably would want to have a substantive engagement on, not something that we sort of do here over the course of a few minutes.
Okay. Further to this engagement, I just want to draw the attention of members to a late submission by the Association of Collective Investments that we have just circulated. I've also made a copy available to National Treasury and SARS, but unfortunately I was not able to allow Ms. Turpin to make an oral presentation because that would set a very bad precedent. I have circulated it, and I trust that if there are issues that perhaps we might want to look into, they would need to be taken into account. And also in our meeting of the 5th, where we took submissions from those that made oral submissions, there is a subsequent letter that was circulated to members from PricewaterhouseCoopers, where PricewaterhouseCoopers raises some concerns with some of the pronouncements made in the meeting. We have circulated those that letter to the members, and I trust that it does clarify some of the things. But with the issue dealt with there, the committee at some point is still going to deal with the issue of PE financing and some of the things. I mean, outside of the taxation laws amendments, because I think it's something that the committee has an interest in, and it would be useful to get into that. But that's not for now. For now, we're dealing with the taxation laws amendments. But then, Mr. Singh.
So thank you very much, Chair. Chair, and I agree with you that it was a correct decision not to allow oral presentations. But I'd just like to know if Treasury and SARS have had sight of this submission from the Association of Collective Investments, and if there are any particular comments or things that they would like to bring to our attention.
Yeah, unfortunately, they also only got a copy now, like all of us. You know, if we had got it earlier, maybe we would have expected them to be able to respond, but I'm not responding on your behalf. You want to respond? say my response is exactly like their response. Unfortunately. Yeah, then having taken these responses today, what we are now left with is for this committee to finally consider the final product. One of the gaps that was identified by some of the presenters was the issue that the process does not allow for time to go back again to see whether what has been raised has actually addressed the problems. We know it is impossible to satisfy everybody and to be able to come up with a product that is to everybody's approval. But for purposes of this engagement, for now, we're going to live with the traditional way. But I think the committee notes that in future, I think we would need to allow for time after you have responded that we actually, I mean, provided there is the presenters still want to make a submission in relation to your responses, we would open space perhaps for that in the future. But at the moment, you know, we really are constrained, and we can't do those changes now. So we are then going to be formally considering these on Tuesday, the 25th. The Taxation Laws Amendment Bill will be formally considered on Tuesday, the 25th. If there is anything that you have picked up, and I think we should allow for time also for people to, if there are still any engagements between yourselves, we allow you space to do that, so that when we return on the 25th, the committee is then able to formally consider the Taxation Laws Amendment Bill. I take this opportunity to thank you all participants, National Treasury, SARS, and all those that made submissions. I know it's you know, under the pressures and the time, it wasn't easy. Mr. Singh spoke about the 24-hour out of 24, you know, and it really was. When I drove out last night, I saw this team coming out of their offices around 8 o'clock, and I said, yeah. We break for tea, and after that we will take 15 minutes, and we have to come back here and look at the committee's report on the budget in order for us to avoid working 24 hours until Friday. Thank you very much. Correct. Thank you. So So we're going to go through it page by page. So we're starting on page one, and if there's anything that members would want to raise on page one, let us do that now. Page one, members, we've corrected the top there, which should actually say 2008/9. Introduction. Members. I must say, Mr. Bedboy is. I know members haven't had a chance of engaging with him. Mr. Bedboy is just sitting here. If there's anything that members raise, you're quite welcome to engage with us so that we can all own the product. And I must say this is actually this is Mr. Bedboy's first report for the committee. And I must say, having read the report, yes, there are areas that we would want to raise, but I think having read the report, one of giving the credit, I think it's done very good way. Okay, Mr. Mitch Phelps.
Thank you, Chairperson. It was good that you reminded us that this was the first report, so that indeed our comments will be constructive and diplomatic. Chair, if I may, then on page one, which is that extended part of the introduction, the second part, the second paragraph, I think it may be more useful to refer to the budget not so much as a document. It's more than just a piece of paper. It's actually a very dynamic instrument. It's not a document per se, you know. And
Ms.
I think that...
Ms. Fox, can you be specific? Which line are you talking
yes,
to?
Yes, that is, of course, that line in the second paragraph is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. The seventh line in the second paragraph of the introduction. A budget can be regarded as a document.
Oh, okay.
And so I am making a suggestion to say a budget is an instrument. It's an instrument in government. It's both a legal, economic, social, it's all of these instruments which reflect the priorities. The priorities of government, and then, of course, these sub-details. But the main thing is that is the national priorities of the government are reflected in the budget.
Okay.
So, Chair, I hope that's sufficient without having to add more comment there.
Okay. Yeah, one thing, in that same paragraph, in fact, I thought I would allow members first to speak. I thought that paragraph also just needs a bit of cleaning up. The third line on that paragraph says the report consists of different sections. I don't think we really. And then it says in the first section, an overview is given of the economic environment within which the budget was tabled. And then an overview of the current macroeconomic environment is important as development. That sentence, I don't know how the committee feels, because I thought perhaps from that sentence, including that line which defines what the budget is, because yes, it is Mr. Bedboy's first report, but this is not the first report of the committee. So beginning to define what the budget is, and I mean, I think it's a bit superfluous. I don't know, but I wanted the committee to comment on that. That line, the sentence that says the report consists of different sections, I would imagine we just need to zero in to say the first section deals with X, Y, Z. And then we go on to say the second section. And also, going forward, the issue of referring to it as the first section, and if you go to page two, we say section two focuses on whatever. So there needs to be some consistency. If we are going to refer it as the first section, the other one is then the second section.
if we say Section 1, if we're going to say Section 1, then all of them will refer to them as Section 1, Section 2, Section 3. I mean, I would imagine that would be much more elegant. But these are minor things that I thought I would raise in general. Because when we go on and the other ones, we say the final section, and we have referred to the others as Section 4, Section 1, the first section. Maybe there needs to be that consistency. But let's first agree whether we are agreed that we remove the portion that outlines what the budget is. Are we okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay. If we are okay with that, then, Mr. Redboy, first that sentence which says the report consists of different sections, and then we start here by saying, if we say the first section, then the others will be the second section, the third section, and so forth. Ms. Fabs?
Chair, there's just the other thing is, this is an oversight report. That's what it's all about, exercising our oversight here. And I think it may be useful, just as we clean up that second paragraph in the manner in which you have suggested, it's not so much that we're giving an overview of anything. We've actually deliberated on this budget as part of our exercise of oversight. And in exercising that oversight, we have covered two or three of these areas. And these, in fact, the report is the report on that oversight and that reflection. I think that it's important to swing what is our job. Our function is oversight.
Right.
It's not to provide any overviews, you know, sort of previews, forwards, that kind of thing of any book. It's just oversight.
Okay. Are we okay with that? I want us to move on to page 2. In fact, that part, the introduction, we should just deal with it as one section. It starts from page 1 up to page 2. And I would imagine those are the minor things that I actually had picked up also. Is there anything else on the introduction? If none, I want us to then move on to macroeconomic outlook. That's a good one.
Thank you, Chairperson. This is something that I picked up at the very last paragraph of the introduction. It's actually a repetition of the final section.
Yes, you said in the final section on the other line, and then again there is the final section.
And the recommendations.
Yeah. But then I would mean that is why if you strike that consistency that we spoke about, if you refer to them as Section 1, Section 2, Section 3, when you say it's the fourth section, you won't repeat the fourth section. You will say the fifth section. But then if you say the first, the second, and then when you get to the last one, the really last one would be the final section. Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'd also say that. Thank you. Okay, macroeconomic outlook. On macroeconomic outlook, I think on the third, one, two, three, fourth line, is just a repetition of again there. These same factors resulted in some revisions to the GDP as per the medium-term budget policy statement. There is the term budget, I don't know, but repeated there. Term budget, you know, the term budget in with caps before policy. Yeah, it should just say the medium term budget policy statement, yeah. Yeah, so it's just a typo, I would imagine. The other thing I don't know, you at the last sentence in that paragraph, we say the minister highlighted the fact that the global environment is significantly different from last year. I'm not too sure. I don't have the actual words of the minister, but I think we need this needs to reflect that we are saying it's different. Is it unfavorable? Is it, you know, it could be different in a good way, or it could be different in that it has new challenges. I mean, you know, in this case, we know that we have new challenges that otherwise did not exist. I don't know how we would put that. It's also a minor thing.
Anything else on macroeconomic outlook? We take the whole macroeconomic outlook. It's page 2 and up to the top of page 3. Mrs. Phelps.
Listen, the revisions in the GDP may be positive or negative or somewhere in the middle. The revision is a very neutral term. What are we saying there? You know, they may have become necessary. They may have been, in fact, an upward improvement in everything. So if our connection, these factors, all of that resulted in some revisions upwards or whatever, it may be necessary to look at that. It is reflected in the second paragraph. You'll see here where there's a reference to, I think, Loebsch and various other people talking about high commodity prices, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But the last line on that page, perhaps in the current environment, it is absolutely necessary to protect investor confidence in South Africa's growth outlook beyond that. Is that what the committee is saying? Or who is saying that? Is that our comment?
Thank you, Ms. Phelps. That is not what the committee is saying. That is also not what I am saying. It's actually a comment made by Mr. Laubser of Sanlam. It's actually I did not reference properly. Thank you.
I think we must do that if it still flows from what Mr. Lopshire said. Mr. Biza.
Thanks, Commissioner. On page 2, paragraph 2, I think also here is a matter of inconsistency in terms of referring to institutions or referring to individuals. I think we need to be clear. If Mr. Mondo was representing IDC, we should talk about IDC. If we're talking about FEDUSA, not the individual that was representing FEDUSA in the meeting. So that we don't see Mr. Mondi and FEDUSA or Mr. Mondi IDC in another paragraph. We know exactly who we're talking about.
Okay, are we agreed there? Because perhaps also in your footnote, if you could say, because you've identified Mr. Mondi there as a part of the panel of economists, perhaps if you could actually say that Mr. Mondi is the chief economist from the IDC. Yes, it's part of the panel, but chief economist IDC. So that even if you refer to him as a person, but, you know, those are attributed to him, correct?
Chair, just on that point as well, if I may just add, support the colleague there. Yeah, I think it's a question of drafting, because at the back, on the last page, we've got the list of people that presented, but those numbers don't correspond with this, so I don't know what's the relation to 1 and 2 on the first page and 3 and 4 on the second page. Where does it link up? And I agree with colleague there that maybe we should rather name the institution they come from, and at the end in the glossary we... You see, we say part of the panel of economists, number 3. But where is 3 after that? In the end, you've got a list, which I looked at. But Mr. Mondi is not number 3. He's number 5. So...
Yeah, but with the footnotes, the footnote need not necessarily reflect the numbering at the back. It's in this page, you've put the 3 next to Mr. Mondi, and then you explain it at the bottom. Not only for names, that referencing would be for, yeah. For instance, if you go to page 8, you look at 6, it says according to National Treasury, and you've got the 6, and then he explains that the reference National Treasury henceforth refers to the presentations made by Treasury and its subsidiary, South African Revenue Services, during the budget hearing, just to identify what is on that page. So that when you read it, your understanding is also supported. Who else? Whose hand was up? But, no, okay.
So, chairperson, are we taking the names of the institutions or the individuals?
That if you, for instance, look at FEDUSA, say it is the view of FEDUSA, what, but, you know, with the other presenters like Mr. Mondi, like Mr. Lobsha, you know, they represent institutions also, where they come from. So it's important that we say where they come from, even in the body of the report. Okay. Key macroeconomic indicators. GDP growth. Mr. Singh?
Chair, on the second line, it is expected that growth will slow down to 4, should have been percent.
Percent, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Mr. Murray?
Mr. Chair, isn't there an easier way to do this? I mean, isn't there a way that we can ask Mr. Witboy that this must just be technically and vocabulary and, you know, be sorted out and, you know, be looked after? Because, I mean, for us to go through every line now, it means that we're going to miss some issues as well.
No. Yeah, that's the general one. But other than that, what I was asking members, during your reading, you might have just picked up something which, if we miss it here, then you did pick it up during your reading. Because otherwise, I mean, to be honest, I read through the report. If I were to, I mean, rate this report, I would just give Mr. Webboy 88 or 89% and pass the report.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but that's not what we want to do. We just want to go through and, I mean, satisfy ourselves that, you know, one, that it's a true reflection of the committee's views, that also it's a true reflection of what also transpired in the hearings, and that it captures by the process, and that's all. And, you know, with the rest of the other pages, I don't think, you know, with the first one, the issues that members are raising are matters that I had also raised. And with the other one, I just read through and I didn't find anything. So it's only those few, and Ms. Fabs, we are now.
I certainly concur with what you said, but with one, maybe just addition. You see, as I read through this report, we were very fortunate to get it yesterday, and I must thank through you, Mr. Witboy, on this issue. It's good to have the evening to study through the report. But when I came to the end, one of the things that I thought I must raise here, the report is well written, that's clear, and it flows. The problem I have is that if I just look at the area of inflation, but the principle applies to the whole report, we'll say Mr. Mondi did this, Mr. Lobshaw said this, and the Deucer said something, and so on and so on and so forth. What are we saying? We're there to listen, having assimilated, analysed what the minister put on the table, getting the comment from these other external people. We're then required to assimilate that information, deliberate on it, and say, in our opinion, I mean, do we agree with this or not? What do we think we're looking at? And we do not put our comment of our oversight in the report. And that is really, for me, a broad comment throughout. The information here is factual. I have no problem with that.
Are you then saying, Ms. Fabs, that we should use this opportunity to say what the committee is saying? But we need to go through the report, and then if the committee fails on a particular matter, we need to deliberate. Here is the committee. We are this committee. But also what we have at the end is a set of recommendations that has been circulated to members, where that's also part of the committee's pronouncement, which we are still going to come to when we get to the end. It's been circulated to members, and I think members have got that. But if members, as we go through these things, members have every right to say, yes, this is what came out, and the committee is meeting as we speak, and then the committee can pronounce, because Mr. Red Boy is not going to put down here what the committee didn't say on that day. Okay, on page 3, we've dealt with GDP growth, gross fixed capital investment on at the bottom. Is there anything, Mr. Johnson?
Chair, just a quick one on first paragraph on 1.1.1, still on GDP growth. I think it makes sense if you were to take on that first paragraph, the very last sentence, and join it with the very first sentence, second sentence. Yeah. It is expected that the growth will slow down to 4% during 2008. The expected loan growth, that would be the follow-up to that sentence. Expected following, I mean, loan growth, slowing down of growth of for 2008 can be attributed to this continent, rather than having to break it and then come back to it.
Okay. Are you happy with that? Are you okay? For the flow, Mr. Johnson recommends that the, because you refer to the slowing down of growth, the sentence that talks about the slowing down of growth being attributed to slower global growth and softer growth in household consumption comes immediately after that one for the floor. Okay. Okay, gross fixed capital investment. If none, inflation.
If I can express my personal future on the inflation, I think the Treasury is saying that the inflation will be within the range in 2009, I think, yeah. But in my view, looking at the current situation globally, I doubt if we that will get within the range in 2009. The food prices, oil prices are the main causes of inflation pressures. In China, it got U.S., there's no recession in U.S. So I think due to those factors, you know, globally, I don't think that will be, in my view, the what they come to say, will with the department or Reserve Bank will have the inflation target within the range by 2009.
Mr. Mgoni says the Treasury is overambitious. that is personal view. It's not the view of the committee yet. Until the committee says so. At the moment, it's Mr. Mguni who says no. They're over ambitious. Together with his economists also, it's unlikely that we will realize it. All things being equal, if they remain like this. But what are the members say? Mr. Mloto, and then Ms. Fab. What Mr. Mlodo is saying is that perhaps in the recommendations we should actually indicate that we would want a regular update from National Treasury on progress being made towards the achievement of that. That's going to be a problem because the National Treasury will say, no, we set the policy. But the people that you should hold accountable is not us, is the Reserve Bank. You see, that's why I'm saying it's going to be a challenge. I think let's look, if there's any issue, I would say let's refer to the recommendations and stipulate it within the recommendations.
Can we flag that, Mr. Mguni, and you formulate, whilst we continue, just formulate the way in which it is going to be captured as a recommendation. Ms. Fatsa.
Having said what Mr. Mlodo said, indeed, it constrains my opinion because I think it's been put very well. I do think, though, having noted that this is the preserve of the Reserve Bank, that particular area, and that it enjoys a certain element of independence. Nevertheless, as Mr. Lotto said, it is Treasury that lays down the policy. This is our policy, and this is how, on the basis of the policy set, these are the targets, and it is because of this is how they will be met. But I think the points that Mr. Mguni has raised are external environmental issues over which we don't have that amount of control. We don't control the global condition. And so I think in taking it through to recommendations, we ought to just note that again, that there are areas which the Minister himself noted over which we have very limited control, and they are these external factors.
Okay, let's reserve the debate for when we can come to the recommendations on inflation. Current account? If nothing on the current account, employment? Members don't have to invent things if there is none. Then the second section deals with fiscal policy. And we must just check, Mr. Redboy, that your numbering is in line with what you had said in the introduction with regards to the section. Okay? Yeah. Ms. Fabs?
You just went too quick for me. I had made a note here and I couldn't find it. It was to do with exports.
Now that you've found it, just zero and
yeah. Very good. Exports have not grown considerably. Page six. It have not grown considerably. It's in the paragraph starting the growth, third line. This is primarily as a consequence of the electricity crisis. I'm not so sure. How old is this electricity crisis, Chair, that it's now going to be held responsible for the exports last year?
Chair? Mr. Mlotto?
I think it was in June. I mean, Ms. Fabs is right.
I think Ms. Fabs is right, because we can't tell even at this stage what the impact of the electricity crisis is. It's what you are predicting. So I think this sentence must come out. Because it's as if it's already a fact. And we don't have the figures with us to prove that.
Okay. Then let's look at that paragraph in its entirety now. It says, the growth referred to earlier in gross fixed investment necessitated the importation of capital goods. This, in a sense, has increased imports relative to exports and driven the current account deficit higher. Exports have not grown considerably. And then we say this is primarily as a consequence of the electricity crisis, which we say that one comes out. And then National Treasury believes that the more efficient utilization of electricity and the continued high commodity prices of platinum and gold will alleviate some pressure on the current account. Should we leave that one on? Okay. So the one that comes out is the one that says this is primarily.
Can I? Chairperson, I think on that point that what's being contested now, it's not what we are saying as a committee. This is what FEDUSA said to us in their presentation, and then it has been written as it was said. So I don't think that it would be fair to try and put words into their mouth, because they said that unless if this was recorded under recommendations from the committee, I think it would be wrong. So I would suggest that it remains where it is, because in the other lines on the previous page, on page 5, it says that FEDUSA said all these things that goes up to page 6.
Yeah, but no, there are two people mentioned there. The last person mentioned is Mr. Mondi. It's not FEDUSA. It says, according to FEDUSA, the high consumption expenditure together with a high level of investment by both governments, it's only that sentence that is FEDUSA's
And after that, Mr. Mondi points out that the demand for imported intermediate goods increased rapidly as many domestic manufacturing enterprises. He highlighted the following. I mean, then I would imagine if we are to attribute it to anybody, it would be Mr. Mondi and not Fedusa. Is that so, Mr. Van Bon? So this is actually, I think the difficulty is that, you know, as you continue in your paragraph, you can't always keep on saying, but Mr. Mondi said this, Mr. Mondi said this. That is why it helps. I don't know how we would reference that, because if this came out from Mr. Mondi's presentation, then Ms. Makoto is correct that we can't remove it, if it did come out of his presentation. Ms. Fox?
I think we need to adopt a cautionary note here, because unless we can all put our heads on a block and say Mr. Mondi said that the lack of growth in exports is the result of the electricity crisis, and I can tell you that's not what he would have said. He would never have said that because he had no figures.
How do you know?
No, he's the sort. I wasn't there, Chair, but he is the sort of fellow
If we are not sure of anything that a person might have said, let's first verify it before it stays in the report. But if he did say it, we shouldn't say he wouldn't say those things. When he has said them, he has said them. Yeah. He can only say he was quoted out of context, but he might have said it. But, Mr. Venpo, can we just verify if this is not what Mr. Mondi said, or if it is not something that we can concretely, you know, we can actually prove that he said?
Chairperson, can we perhaps go to the specific line, because I deleted a sentence here that is primarily a consequence of the electricity crisis. Now that is not what Mr. Mondi said. When that paragraph starts, the growth referred to earlier. So that is where I come in. That is not what Mr. Mondi said. That's me.
Then let's remove that, because Joe Fox knows Mr. Mondi so well that he knows what he wouldn't have said. Okay, so let's remove it. Let's remove that this is the primary consequence of... Okay. Right. Employment? I trust that the reason why I'm running fast is because I expect that members will have made notes where there is something to raise. So if members are quiet, I will just move on to the next one. Fiscal policy, which is now the second section. On fiscal policy on page 10, at the top, where we have the opinion expressed by IDASA, where they compare the effects of a budget surplus with a budget deficit. In their view, a positive budget, I would imagine budget balance, because if it's a positive budget, you know, it's either we say a budget surplus, that's a positive budget balance. So I would imagine if we say it's positive, then it will be the balance. Am I correct? Yeah. So it's not surplus, it's balance. But if we want to use budget surplus, then we remove positive. Mr. Mlot.
Let's be clear on one thing. Was this expression or view by IDASA during the hearings or prior the hearings?
Thank you, Mr. Molato, for that. While doing the report, sometimes it was necessary for me to actually go deeper into certain things, and it also wasn't part of the budget hearings. So that basically just post the budget hearing, something that I read up on. So it was not part of the hearings.
Okay, but BIDASA did submit a written submission, did they? They didn't.
Oh, okay.
And then I would imagine if that is the case, maybe we should not have them in our report at all. If they didn't have, I mean, either a written or a, yeah, because it might be their story in the media, and they might not. Yeah, well, maybe let's just remove the data altogether. Yeah. And if there are any other paragraphs of people that actually did not physically appear or submit written submission, we shouldn't refer to them in our report. Mr. Singh or Mr. Mgune? Well, Mr. Johnson, sorry.
Name change.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry to take you back. Just quickly on employment. Just trying to understand very briefly on the figure 2, the formal employment in different sectors. My observation there, whilst I was not in the session itself, is that there is only emphasis there on electricity issues, very one line on a manufacturing, and brief statistics on analysis on unemployment, and also on skills issues, and also on social security, which is the very last paragraph. I wasn't there, as I say, but I would have imagined perhaps there could have been a lot that in the mining sector, construction that is doing so much in the country, trade with the industrial policy activity plan in place now as we speak, and lastly the service area. If there were, perhaps there could also be a need to beef up, especially, you know, the section on employment sectors as espoused in the figure 2 there. Rather than having, as said by one comrade here, there seems to be too much of emphasis again on electricity issues, given all what we have granted. But we also needed to say a little more on other sectors of employment that have been created, especially in the construction industry. I wasn't there, but I would imagine these areas also would need to be, you know, picked up.
Yeah, unfortunately, Mr. Johnson, you're not helping because you're not telling us what to say and where should the information should come from. What is in Figure 2 there is extracted as it is from the budget review of 2008. And those are the exact percentages. And I don't think we will be able to go beyond that because we don't do that. And when you come to page 7, all that page 7 does at the top there is then to just to explain what figure 2 has. And perhaps we also don't want to find ourselves in a situation where we invent some of the things that otherwise didn't come up. That's what we're trying to avoid.
Yeah, so my issue here is whoever shall have been presenting, including the minister, I am saying the point I'm raising here is I would imagine that there also could have been other issues said on that figure without really having to rehash anything new by ourselves. That's all that I'm saying. Perhaps my question is whether, directly put, did we also have other people making contributions on other areas except for electricity, social security, and so on and so forth? And if we did have those, and perhaps we needed also to add, that's all what I'm saying, if there were any.
Okay. I don't know. Other members, as far as I'm concerned, this actually captures this adequately. I don't know what other members feel might have been left out.
Yeah, I think the researcher tried to capture all those that were said as underemployment, and this is what it covers. So some of the things now they might appear as in the different sectors. None were said of the different sectors. Only those that were said appeared here.
Okay.
Chairperson, an elaboration on figure two, that formal employment. that would basically be a repetition of the budget review, and then that is what I did not want to do.
You can't do that. Okay. Now, fine. On page 10, that's where we were, exchange controls. Next slide.
I actually just had my hand up to refer to the fiscal one just before we got there for the last comment on page 9. But I think then we move to employment, yeah.
What one, that one,
if I could just get a clarification just in this area, because I feel if I don't understand it, I'm not sure, you know, whether my children
what, which
will.
One, Ms. Fox? Just
it's page nine. The last paragraph, this, as they point out, really means that the government would maintain a surplus on its balance. Okay. And on that, my question for clarification is, are we referring to the balance this year, the balance of the 2008-2009, per se, the MTES balance, because then we refer to the actual balance deficit would mean that the structural balance would be a large deficit. And the structural balance is a three-year process. So I think that if this is not an easy thing for anyone to understand, but perhaps if we could just be clearer. That's all, Chair.
You want to, because I think that's producer's comments now with regards to the figure three graph that was taken directly from the budget review. But that's producer's comment. You want to talk to that, Mr. Bedford?
Thank you, Chairperson. Ms. Fab, do you want an elaboration from the committee side? More clarity in terms of the structural budget balance? Is that what you require in the report?
Chairperson, if I could comment through yourself, your good offices there. You see, in the last paragraph on the second line, we actually say on the third line, the cyclically adjusted or structural budget. And our comment is, as Fedusa correctly points out, they don't say this themselves. So we comment there, we say, as they are now correct. We then come into their point again, and I'm just saying that having said this, we're doing a further interpretation. This, as they point out, we're interpreting what they've said. And can we not just clarify the interpretation?
I think what it says here, it says, like you've correctly said also yourself, Ms. Fass, is that this, as Fedusa points out, really means that government must maintain a surplus on its actual balance, on its actual balance. That's what Fedusa says, yeah. But the correctness that is not attributed to that one. The correctness is attributed to the sentence where it says, Fedusa correctly points out that it's an approach which helps government in getting an idea of temporary revenue gains, full stop. Yeah.
Surplus, Chair.
Yes, but now what they are saying is that they mean that government must maintain this surplus. And that's what they say in their submission, that government must maintain this surplus. That's all they're saying. And they did say. Can we have the benefit of that?
I get the argument that we are supporting Fedusa, of which we are not saying that. Expressing an opinion on what Fedusa is saying. That's what Joy is saying.
Because
as correctly pointed out Fedusa, which means we are supporting their point that they are correct, they are saying that. And they were not saying that.
Yes,
we must just point out that Fedusa says 1, 2, 3.
We are not.
What we do is you go back there to say the cyclically adjusted or structural budget, as Fedusa points out. So we remove the correctly. That's all we do.
I've already done that, sir.
Yeah. Okay. Page 11. Are you still on 10, Mr. Singh?
Yes,
I think it's just a typo on the last paragraph, Mr. Lope, the one that starts with Mr. Lopesha, third sentence, and will enhance, not enhanced, hedging possibilities.
Okay.
You got that.
Thank you. You got that, page 10, where...
The third line.
Yeah.
Lopesha.
Mr. Lopesha, the new regulations will encourage two-way trade and will enhance hedging. Possibilities. Okay. Expenditure side of the budget, page 11. Page 12, social security reforms. Social security reforms. Page 13, electricity crisis. Mr. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. If I remember correctly, I did ask a question to business for Boozer about the demand side of this problem. And business's view was that the electricity levy was not going to change consumer behavior. And I would like that to be put into this report, because I think it's a very important point that they raised. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Otherwise, it's not there. No, it's not. On page 13 to 14, that's now on the electricity crisis. Mr. Mlotto.
Yeah, I think you can record it as that Busa is of the opinion that the electricity levy is not going to change the behavior of consumers, full stop. But then the other issues that follows, I'm not sure whether that's what we want to capture. Where it says the introduction of the levy raises a number of issues. Firstly, small businesses and households use a lower proportion of the total electricity consumption than large.
Mr. Mlotto, where are you?
At the bottom of 13.
Right.
It says the question is, should the same tariff apply to small businesses and households? I'm not sure which opinion is that one. Secondly, to what extent will poor households continue to receive free basic electricity?
Yeah.
I would say let's take out that and capture what Dr. George has said, that Busa is of the opinion that the electricity levy is not going to change the behavior of consumers, full stop.
Okay. Okay. Are we fine then? Also, I don't know, in the first sentence there says, in the light of the electricity crisis in South Africa, the minister made a commitment to building energy capacity in South Africa through a 60 billion handover to Eskom.
Yeah, handover.
The handover part. Pardon? It would be, I mean, through the injection of the 60 billion, whatever. Yeah. Mr. Mlotto.
Because I think the use of the word injection would be better, because the minister emphasized that this is not a grant. There will be conditions attached to this thing. So I think the injection would be a safer option.
Okay. Anything else on the electricity crisis? If Mr. Singh?
Chair, page 14.
Right.
Second paragraph. In announcing additional 60 billion funding arrangement, Minister stated that. Nothing, however, was mentioned on how the 60 billion will be funded. All economists on the panel, that's the line now, all economists on the panel believe that the finance instrument to be used should be equity. In other words, government being the sole shareholder in providing the 60 billion funding. I just don't... understand that.
Let's clarify that.
I thought what they were saying is government should give an outright 60 billion and not. Is that what they were saying? And it shouldn't be refundable.
Yeah.
But yeah. But the way it's put.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think that, the economist, the point that the economist made was that the 60 million should be not handed over and given to funded to Eskom and then not through borrowed capital, but rather through equity financing. Government will then be the sole shareholder, and government will then in future receive dividends on that investment that they made in Eskom. I think that was the point that the suggestions by the panel of economists.
Yeah.
So in other words, borrowed capital versus vis-a-vis equity financing. So they suggested rather equity financing instead of debt financing.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I accept that, Chair, but I think maybe it needs to be crafted.
I think you should elaborate more on it so that it, whoever reads it actually finds that same meaning out of it. Okay, revenue trends and tax proposal. Oh, Ms. Watt, on electricity crisis.
And mine would be to you, Chairperson, because I'm sure that you would be able to clarify this yourself. Is it a kilowatt hour? Because I wasn't aware we paid electricity on hours. You know, if this is the...
Where is this now?
It's on page 13, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, the fifth line from the bottom. I thought that kilowatts was the amount of wattage used even in a second or minute.
But it's got the stroke H there.
But it's definitely hour here, and I'm sure there's a mistake.
Yeah, but that's how the 2 cents is levied. It's on a kilowatt hour.
Yeah, that's right.
It is correct.
Per hour.
Yeah.
So you reduce it
yes.
then. The last thing, Jay, which you again just...
Why did you think
because I think that more men know about these electricity issues.
Yeah.
No. It's an electricity crisis, and I think we must avoid any puns. We don't want laughter in the house. In the light of, lights and electricity generally go hand in hand. I would have thought we would have avoided the word light on the subject, you know.
I missed that one.
No, that it starts the paragraph in the light of the electricity crisis, and everyone will laugh. What light is there? The fact is, there's an absence of light.
Of light, in the absence of the light. Oh, where are we now?
It was 4.2, directly under 4.2.
In the light. Oh, okay. Yeah.
It's not it won't be an opportunity for laughter.
Okay, that's it on the electricity crisis. Let's move on, members. Page bottom of 14, revenue trends and tax proposals.
Yes.
Ms. Makoto.
Yeah.
Your mic?
Okay, thanks. On the last paragraph of 4.4, 4.2, just a minor correction, where you have written infrastructure, I think it's one word, right? And then on revenue trends, on 2008-2009 budget you must put in two. Thanks, sir.
That's it on Is that it on the tax proposals and revenue thing, trend? Then page 16. That's still 5.1. On page 17, I just want to be clarified here, Mr. Redboy. Page 17, the first paragraph, last sentence. It says, in other words, if this revenue component is added to the income of individuals in both categories, it exceeds the threshold, then the threshold will not apply anymore. The whole paragraph.
Can I just read the sentence there?
Yeah.
Of note here is that these thresholds exclude the tax interest-free components. In other words, if this revenue component, now that revenue component I'm referring to there is the interest-free components. In other words, interest income. So if that is added to the personal income of individuals, then the thresholds that apply in the absence of interest-free income will not be valid anymore. So a new threshold will then apply, which will be inclusive of the interest component.
Okay, we then move on. Businesses and small businesses. What are we saying here? In your heading, businesses and small businesses. Am I missing something?
Yeah.
Small businesses are also businesses. Yeah. Well, maybe we could have just said corporate business and small business relief. I mean, if that is what we want to talk to. Yeah. Corporate and small business relief. Okay. That goes up to 22 other tax proposals. Mr. Singh.
Sorry, I'm a bit slow, sir.
And Ms. Fox. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm a bit slow. I just going to go back to page 18 on the top.
We are there. Yeah.
Right. The South African economy needs a robust inducement to boost domestic savings and the review and subsequent cut of the taxation on retirement funds would be a step.
Where on page?
The first step, two lines.
All right, the first
page
line.
Page 18,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just, South African economy needs a robust inducement to boost domestic saving and the review and subsequent cut off. According to Pedusa, yeah. These are, but and the subsequent cut off the taxation. So what are we saying? They didn't want taxation.
Cut off the taxation on retirement funds.
Yeah.
Subsequent reduction, perhaps, let's say so. Subsequent reduction of the taxation on retirement funds.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Reduction.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, Ms. Fobbs?
Thanks very much, Chair. I now feel the Chair, on page 18, moving into 19, it's the same point. The principle in the second paragraph on page 19 is in that second paragraph, the first line, where the sentence is, and which specifically relate emphasis of. I would have thought we could just have said which specifically emphasizes that. In other words, just to simplify it, and then the same applied to page 19, the same principle, and that is on page 19 in the second paragraph under businesses and small businesses, in specific. Why don't we just say specifically, and then in the third paragraph, remove inter alia, because of course, after all, it's a legalese issue, and just put as is evident, instead of as is inter alia evidenced by. So it's, all I'm proposing is just a matter of simplification, and I looked all over for where SAITE, the South African Institute of Tax People, I suppose it is located, and I didn't really see it. I happen to know that's what it is, more or less, but I didn't see the earlier spelling out of who they were. You know, and that's not everyone knows who SAITE is.
Are we together? But, yeah.
Okay, Chapetan, on page 19 and page 18, I wanted to check the issue of cross-referencing on the footnotes, because they don't seem to be talking to the contents in the two pages. I tried to get this footnote number 12 on page 19. I can't find it. Even footnote number 10 and 11 on page 18, if you can properly locate it. But the other thing that comes on page 19, on the very same footnote I referred to, I think it would be more appropriate if you could have explicitly indicated what these means here, so that a person should not... The footnote, page 19, where they say that the incidental use of these items. So I would suggest that there should...
The 12.
It's not located anywhere, even on page 18. That's what
can
I was raising.
Yeah, can we then check on that? You see, in the table there on page 19... In the table on page 19, propose that incidental private use of work cellular phones and laptops be tax-free. Those are the these. Those are the ones we're talking to. Yeah. And the 11, that's where 11 is also. It's on, yeah. It's there. Okay. Okay, can we move on?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I have done some formatting in the meantime on my document and cut out some things. So when the reference is made to a specific page number, then I'm a bit lost. Can members, honorable members, please refer to the specific paragraph, please?
And then can you yourself have the original one that you haven't formatted? You don't put us in a situation because we want to refer to the pages as well.
No, just formatting in terms of line spacing, basically. That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Now, fine. Ms. Fabs.
Chairperson, on page 19, and this would be directed at yourself, Chairperson, I was of the opinion last year, and of course early this year, that the South African company tax rate was in line with international trends. It would be useful to learn what is not in line with it. I don't know.
Let's now, can you refer me up?
Chair,
right.
Second paragraph under business, under the small business there, the second paragraph, last line, this would bring South Africa's company tax rate more in line with international trends. Last year we had an input from SARS with tables gained from the Economist, Nochal.
Why can't I find it now? Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it actually showed us how much we were in line with international trends.
But isn't this what SAITE was saying?
No, he's not qualified. He's not right.
Continue. That's what SAITE said. Yeah. Because, that's what they said. Yeah. Yeah, because if it just says this would bring, I understand Ms. Fabs's,
Okay, this goes up to 22. And then other text proposals.
Chairperson, I think in one of the inputs, it might be, is it Shusla or who, the one who, that economist, he mentioned that he was talking about the indirect taxes, that there is a need to, you know, to reduce, further reduce, scrap.
Where are we now?
On corporate tax and small business tax relief.
Yeah.
Because he highlighted that there is a need to either scrap corporate tax and then to introduce, VAT, that is indirect taxes, so that you are able to capture the benefit.
Mr. Mlod.
Mr. Schuster said that Mike Schuster. Mr. Schuster said that I think his opinion is that, no, we'll have to rephrase this. He said that he's recommending that VAT be increased to 18%, not to 17, increased by 3%, to 17%, so that corporate tax can be lowered further.
Can you just make sure that you capture that that sentiment that was raised by Mr. Schuster, because it's important. Not Leon Schuster. Mike Schuster, Mr. Singh.
Yeah, Chair, I haven't been seeing who said what here, but I know Schuster said a lot. and he said a lot of things that were sort of controversial, in inverted commas.
Yeah.
Now, I don't see much of what he said being captured here. I mean, I haven't looked deep enough to see who said what.
Yeah.
But I think we've got to bring in some of the things that he said to give a counterbalance to what the others were saying.
Okay.
Chairperson, I was a little bit reluctant to include the good, the bad, and the ugly part.
Don't exclude it.
Because
you attribute it to the person who said it, but it must be in the report.
Mr. Schuster's presentation also lacked a lot of referencing, and you also mentioned that.
Yeah.
So
he promised to give us those, and he never did, did he? Yeah, those that were not properly referenced, please don't refer to them. But I mean, some of the points he raised, you know, as long as you attribute them to the person, that's fine. Okay, Mr. Mlod.
The other issue that Mr. Schuster, which we need to capture, is that he was saying internationally there is a trend to move from direct taxation to reliance on indirect taxation. Those SARS contest that. But I think that is his opinion. We need to record that.
Page 24, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to add to that. I agree on what Mr. Schuster had said, that it should be recorded. But in response, Bruza said they did not think that it was a good idea to increase VAT at this time. So I think that should go in there as well to balance it off. Thank you.
Both those sentiments, Mr. Schuster, and the Bursawat on the issue of indirect taxes. Okay, page 24, Mr. Singh.
Page 21, second paragraph, fourth line. The paragraph is started, National Treasury proposes, blah, blah, blah. Then the second sentence is, second sentence starts with the proposal. Third sentence is, furthermore, National Treasury has announced cascading relief. Not relief. Okay.
Yes, Chair, you've already made the point about Schuster and Bursa. And I want, you know, I think that Mr. Bitboy has noted here at the bottom of page 22, in the opinion of Boosa, the so-called business angel. And I think that phrases such as business angel, which are their phrases, of course, not ours, indicate that Beauty and the Beast could have been brought into Shusla. In inverted commas, of course.
So I don't know what to do with the style, because at the bottom of 24 is at the end of the other taxes. We ask a question with regards to the deregistration of those that fall below the required threshold. I mean the style of reporting, I don't think we can leave it as a question, would to be forced to register. Maybe whether they will have to deregister. If we could leave it at that, so that it doesn't stay with the question mark there. Okay, page 24, sixth conclusion. And then seven is the separate.
Sorry, sir.
Yep.
On conclusion.
Yeah.
That on page 25, the first sentence says the table budget takes into all the constraints underlying the South African macroeconomic environment. I think that's a bit of a generalization. Also consideration, but not necessarily all. You know, I mean, how do we know that it's all the constraints of the macroeconomic? So, on the first sentence, page 25, top. Table
okay.
Takes into maybe account constraints underlying the South African economic environment, but to qualify it as being saying all the constraints, that means that we know everything possible.
Okay.
And we don't know. That's the first point, sir. And then in that last paragraph of six, that's a very difficult paragraph. It says, in a sense, the budget passes three tests. I think what a sense means. You know, must first qualify sense. And then in this regard, the budget appears to be allocatively efficient. That's very subjective. I don't think that is a general opinion.
Look, maybe let's just agree that the entire last paragraph. Let's just remove the paragraph. Let's it ends it in too much of a complimentary note. I don't think that's our duty. Ms. Fabs.
It's certainly not our duty. Chair, on page 24, starting with the conclusion, it's just a very small point here. The budget focuses on investing to raise. I thought we may just say on investment, the noun, to raise X, Y, Z. The last point here, the tax measures that are proposed are aimed at supporting investment growth and job creation. If we accept that, then it may mean that the point that has been made here earlier, just before me, about the table budget and the constraints, could be better phrased and linked to this point. You see, you've got the tax measures that are proposed, the expenditure side, taking into account there, and then you would overcome that generalization of all the constraints coming into that. I do think that was quite a valid point that was made there, because we're not aware of the externalities in the global environment and this thing. But I'm worried about this sentence here, Chair. Maybe we could have been stronger, perhaps. sound macroeconomic policy will protect the economy from global volatility. No problem. And rising investment in human and physical capital. I know my knowledge of English is somewhat limited. I'm thinking, are we sort of humans as being physical? But what sort of physical capital is that? I mean, are those the stadiums or something? No, I genuinely don't know what we mean. I thought physical was human, you see, but obviously physical is the other concrete issues. Could you just clarify that for me, Chair?
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Ms. Phelps. The point raised actually does be rising investment in human capital such as education. So I would just delete physical capital because that is fixed capital. Thank you.
And the same issue to your chair, I think raised by Comrade Jones on page 25, parallel with this, the budget instrument.
You say parallel with this, the budget documentation outlines ways in which government plans to meet. I think here we're referring specifically to the documentation that is tabled with the budget. Because the budget is tabled with other documents, the budget review, the estimate of national expenditure. That's the documentation that I think we're referring to. Mr. Redboy?
Yes, indeed, Chairperson.
I think it's in two contexts here. At the beginning, what we were referring to is the budget itself as an instrument. And here, now saying, when it is tabled, there are other documentation that also outlines its objectives of raising the level of economic growth. Okay. 7 is the separate document, proposed recommendations. And members, this is now your field. Mr. Samoloto, Kona.
Honestly speaking, I can only see two recommendations here. The first one is that one of ESCOM, where we need details. The second one is that one of the to be briefed by the South African Reserve Bank on the financial. Because let me start with the third one. The fourth recommendation is problematic because CETAs are not within our area of jurisdiction, to use that word. Are we the Department of Labor? And as finance, we can only interrogate the mandate of CETAs or the performance of CETAs within the financial sector. That's the first problem that I'm picking up with this, I would say the fourth recommendation must go, or else we just have to concentrate or focus on CETAs within the financial sector. The third recommendation, I don't know how we're going to get this one right, because we have talked over this issue over a number of years. And, you know, South Africans are like Americans, they're highly indebted. You know, and we had a discussion with National Treasury at one stage. And they said, well, they're trying the best that they can. It's a very complex area. And even the issue of retail bonds is one of the instruments to try to address that. But it's too broad. My problem is that it's too broad. I don't know how we're going to go about that.
Okay. We had you. 4 goes. It doesn't belong here.
Just to add to that, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Marais.
In terms of that fourth one, and I think there was another one, I don't think it must be our recommendation in terms of how improvement must be done, but we can propose or suggest improved governance. That's typically what the minister has also done. He said, you know, that the oversight role of Parliament must be more vigorously. So we can recommend, and I don't think it's only in terms of CETAs, but it's in terms of general accountability of the different departments. I mean, we have given the money, we have approved that, but now there must be accountability. So we can only suggest improved accountability and governance in terms of how they spend their money and whether they spend their money, but it's not our role to do that. It must be Parliament's role, in line with what the Minister has also suggested.
Okay. I need a recommendation that's now in the form of a draft that's presented. So this is what the committee says with regards to the issue of accountability with regard when resources have been allocated to all departments. Mr. Singh?
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I agree with the sentiments wholeheartedly. I don't know whether we can recommend that portfolio committees continue to vigorously monitor respective departments' expenditure or something like that.
Yeah.
Something in that context.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree.
And sorry, my apologies, sir. And what the Minister has also said, that there must be regular progress reports on their spending. So maybe that can be part of what Mr. Singer said, you know, in terms of progress reports, regular progress reports. You know, that is not only a year later that you find out that they haven't done it, but that there's monitoring.
Yeah, but we also should not repeat what is already there. Because
yeah,
regular reports, that's what the PFMA says, that's what the Joint Budget Committee deals with on a monthly basis. They get this report on a monthly basis. And the latest introduction is now performance this thing as well, audit, which comes to Parliament on a monthly basis. All that is left is for Parliament to make sure that it uses that information, because it is there. It's in the legislation, and it comes before Parliament. We all get it. Members of the Budget Committee will tell you that that's what they deal with on a monthly basis. Mr. Johnson.
Including 4%. My worry is whether we do not
In this recommendation, that's not what we're going to do. We're not going to be instructive on committees, but we just recommend that Parliament, makes use of the available monitoring mechanisms that are there. That's what we need to say. Mr. Singh and then Ms. Fox. Are you okay, Mr. Singh?
No.
You're done. Ms. Fox?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's just that, am I to understand, Chairperson, that after we've looked at these four, we would be considering some of the factors that had come up during our overview of the report, the draft, because there were two other recommendations that we wanted to consider.
But these are just proposed ones now.
Yeah.
Your chair.
So then we'll add
to
that.
If there is any. In fact, we have removed 3 and 4, and we have emphasized on the issue of oversight and monitoring.
Yeah.
Which Mr. Malaya raised, and if there are any members, this is the opportunity.
I thought, Chairperson, the one was earlier on in the report when we had different views. I think it came across with the GDP or inflation or somewhere around there, where I think Mr. Malaya had put forward quite a reasonable resolution which could have taken us forward, or it could have been put into the conclusion.
Can somebody just read that?
I'm sure he's deep in his book there.
What I was saying was in response to Mr. Mguni's earlier comment, that is it feasible that National Treasury will realize those to be within that target, given that some of the factors are outside our control. So my argument was that if we start to go on that, National Treasury would say, no, our responsibility is to come up with a policy of inflation targeting and give the best. The success of that is up to you to monitor in your interaction with the South African Reserve Bank. Yeah.
Chairperson,
Thanks, Chair. Just on the wording of number one, in view of what Ms. Fubb said earlier, is we should just maybe change the wording to say, instead of to shed some light on, just to change it to clarify. Thank you.
Very much, Chairperson. Just broadly speaking, I noticed that we've identified everything with the word need, you know, one of Maslow's basic issues. I think we should move beyond the psychological and just into the financial one and talk about should, you know, more in a legal sense, rather, and remove the word needs. So National Treasury should shed whatever, the committee should do this, and the committee should be briefed. Our needs will be addressed by our councillors.
Mr. Mgoli.
As I said, Chair, my opinion that is
yes.
In view of global market volatility and increasing inflationary pressures in the domestic economy, National Treasury and South African Reserve Bank should closely monitor or review inflationary target range set.
That's a
loaded one.
National Treasury and the Reserve Bank, because as we all know that some of the variables are outside of our control. Members, I want us to move towards closure and adoption of this report, and the debate on this appropriation bill is next week, Tuesday. It's only proper that we do it now, because if we don't do it now, then you're coming back on Friday. Not a threat. Okay. So, any mover? The recommendations are fine now. Ms. Fox.
Okay, I really need your indulgence.
I'm seeing that there's some indulgence, Ms. Maria, I'll reduce it now, because I wanted you to stay on until you have
got. No, but this is a 30 seconds. This is 30 seconds, and it simply requires what Mr. Nguni has said. I did disassociate myself from it, and I believe, but however, I know, but having said that, in the conclusion, it may be of value to us. We use the word, it is indeed a balanced budget. I think it may have been better in the light of what has been said to refer to it as a sober budget, which over an MTEF period would need to really focus on exigencies or whatever, such as the inflation, etc. I think it is a pertinent point, but I don't think it should raise alarm bells. So it was just that I think balanced is a word that one would want to leave to a political speech. If one could refer to it more as a sober budget, because it's one of the more sober budgets we've had. Yes, it's sober, that has had to take account of what you've just mentioned, of global economic whatever. And in view of this, in the committee's opinion, National Treasury would have to more closely monitor the pressures creating inflation. Pressures, you know?
Thank you, Judge.
Thanks, Jay. Perhaps instead of balance, we could use the word prudent budget. That, I think, would capture it.
Okay. That's good. In fact, I was beginning to look for the Zulu word for this, and Mr. Singh was going to help me.
But, Chair, since you passed that point, I won't help you on that one. Just on the oral submissions, I think we received written and oral, didn't we receive written? Because they came and presented. So maybe we should just say oral and or written submissions were received from the undermentioned. We take out in the personal capacity and then we list them. We say oral and written submissions were received from the undermentioned and we list them.
That's taken. Dr. Josh.
Thank you, Chair. I just noticed on the number 11, it says Dr. T. George Fedusa. His name is Dennis George. Sorry, T.
You offer D, George, then that causes problems. Even.
Yeah. Well, I think he's Mr., not Doctor.
Can we correct that? Can we make sure that people's names are correctly captured? All the names, if we could just make sure that they're correctly captured. Okay. And because Dr. George only picked it up because this one happens to be a judge.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you must have. Okay. Any move on? Mr. Beza moves for adoption. Any second? Mr. Maria, second. There we go. Thank you very much, members. As amended, yes, with the amendment.
There we go. Members must read it when it's in the ATC so that if there are problems, we can then move the amendment in the House. Because now we won't be able to change it. But thank you very much. Then that leaves us with a free Friday. Members are free to leave tomorrow afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.